Good morning, everyone. What a fine morning it is. Welcome to this House Committee on Transportation Policy, Wednesday, March 8, 2018. I think we'll go a little bit out of order in deference to our colleague, Representative Bence, who's here this morning. Thank you. Computer missing in action. And we will open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 24. No, I'm sorry. Which one are you doing? 2482.
Chairman McEwen, members of the committee, House Bill 2482 allows a filling station, service station, garage, or other dispensary of Class 1 flammable liquids to allow self-dispensing 24 hours per day in counties with certified population of less than 40,000. We have a dash 3 amendment that replaces the bill. It defines the area of Eastern Oregon that would allow 24 hour per day self-dispensing of Class 1 flammable liquids. Requires a dispensary that includes retail space providing goods and services. Must provide an employee to dispense Class 1 flammable liquids between the hours of 6 a.m. and 6 p.m. And allows a dispensary of Class 1 flammable liquids in Classic Courier, Tillamook County, to offer self-service fueling between the hours of 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. We've got the necessary paperwork. There is a minimal revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Gentlemen, if you would like, Mr. Romaine, if you have something to add, please.
I don't know if I have anything to add, but I...
Welcome, Representative Bence.
I'm sure. Members of the committee, Cliff Bence, District 60. Thank you so much for hearing this bill. And we thank you, Madam Chair, for having heard the bill several years ago so that my little cities in Eastern Oregon still have the possibility of having fuel in them. I have some slides to go over very rapidly that actually I think I showed most of some years ago. This, of course, is my district. And this is a statement that you probably already know, that we have just two states left that prohibit self-serve. These are the counties that are under 40,000 people in population. And then this is the key for this in the next slide. So if you look here, you'll notice that we're trying to preserve fuel down here in McDermott, fuel here in Jordan Valley. We would like to have fuel here at the Y. We would like to have fuel down here in Fields. We up here in John Day still have several stations. There's one in Prairie City. There's a couple in John Day and Canyon City. And then out here at Mount Vernon, and then this direction, a few more. There are, of course, several stations along the freeway which have higher volume. The key to all of these smaller towns is to arrange it so that where you have very low volume, you still have fuel. That's the challenge, because we have so few stations. And the inability to keep them open as the minimum wage increases, it becomes more and more difficult to keep people working there. Now, there's been some people who have said, gosh, what about the jobs if we do this? And I would simply say this, and let's go to this next slide. And this gives you the number of service stations in these little towns. These service stations are not Costco. These service stations are not a Pilot or Love's, except up here in Ontario, we have one of each. But these are mom-and-pop outfits. And so when someone says, you're going to get rid of the attendant, my response would be, well, if you don't get rid of the attendant, you ain't going to have a station. The mom-and-pop are going to have to sell it and leave. Because you got one station in these towns. One of the real challenges is, how in the world do you maintain competition? For example, up here in Ontario, we have 8 stations. We want to keep 8 stations because we have price competition. But we are competing against, of course, the two big stations on the freeway, Love's and Pilot. And those have the huge volume. Through the rest of the town, what you have is price. That's how you compete. Now, if you have to hire people to stay out there all the time, you're not going to be able to compete. You're going to close. And there'll only be a couple of stations left, even in Ontario. Now, this is my district. I didn't attempt to do I have 5 counties of those that you saw on the map. But as you can see, we're trying to preserve these stations out in the middle of nowhere so that we have fuel available. That was the whole reason for this bill 2 years ago, and I think the reason it passed. By the way, I want to remind everybody, the bill when it passed out of the House was 24 hours. We all voted for a 24-hour bill. I think it was unanimous. Mm-hmm. And it went over to the Senate, and they cut it back to 12 hours at night. It was the craziest thing, and I stood on the floor and said that. This is the craziest thing, that we would allow self-service in the dark, but apparently not in the daytime. Too dangerous in the daytime to pump your own gas, but you can certainly do it at night. I mean, that was crazy. And so what the whole concept here was to try to make sure we have fuel in these towns as the minimum wage and other costs of employees go up. This bill, however, because people are concerned about those jobs, I'm concerned about those jobs, states now that if there's somebody inside the building, they need to be there needs to be somebody pumping the gas. Okay. In some of these stations, for example, in Jordan Valley, see, not Jordan Valley, but in John Day, and I think up here we have Canyon City. Yeah, Canyon City. I went there the other day, and they have a sign outside that says you can pump your own gas after 6, so that means they are staying open at night, which would not have been the case before. And you might have just had to park and spend the night in John Day while you waited for something to open. That's no longer the case. You can actually pump gas yourself and leave town if you want to. So the amendments, Mr. Romaine is far more familiar with than I and can answer any questions regarding them. I would simply say this is a question of access, not convenience. Access, not convenience. And when it comes to employees, keep in mind, we're trying to preserve the jobs of the owners of these stations, not just those who work perhaps at the island. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Chair. Mr. Romaine, do you have anything else to add?
Madam Chair, I could explain the amendments, if that's...
To the committee, would you like more detail? Yes. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I work with the Romaine Group, and I'm representing the Oregon Fuels Association. These amendments do three things and three things only. First of all, they keep the existing status quo in the on the coast. There are three counties on the coast that are below 40,000. They do not change anything for those. We are not expanding self-service on the coast. We're not doing anything to dealing with self-service on the coast. Those three counties are Curry, Tillamook, and Clatsop. The second thing it does is it allows retail stations in the low population counties in eastern Oregon only to have self-service 24 hours a day. But if one of these stations, or retail stations, has another business attached to it, like a restaurant or a convenience store or anything like that, where there would be an employee available, then they have to have that attendant available to pump the gas if requested by anyone, not just somebody who's handicapped or elderly or anything like that, at no cost. And finally, the amendment allows cardlock stations in those low population eastern Oregon, again, only stations, to go 24 hours cardlock and allow people to come in and use the stations. Frankly, right now, if your company or you have some kind of connection where you can get a cardlock card, you are allowed to use it. Currently, it's really just retail with a monthly bill. But that's all the amendments do. We have worked with everybody. I've sent stuff to all of you, tried to talk to most, if not all of you, regarding these. It's a simple extension for Eastern Oregon only. We heard your concerns about the coast and other parts of Western Oregon. As I told you in the earlier hearing, I personally have a problem at home if I got it in Western Oregon, so I will not attempt to do that in my lifetime. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Questions? Yes, Vice Chair Meyer.
Chair McEwen, I'm still a little bit troubled by the fact that we've got a lot of counties here that, yes, they're further west, and maybe they have some larger towns with availability of fuel, but I know from personal experience that a number of these counties still don't have much in the way of fuel between the larger towns. If you even if you look at the LaGrande, what's the county? Go back one, if you would, Representative Bentz. I apologize, my geography is not good enough. What's our White County up there that's not shaded? That's Umatilla. There's a lot of places in Umatilla County. that would, you could get out in the middle of the night without any ability to get gas if we didn't allow that to happen. So I'm wondering, what is the reason why we don't expand this further so that virtually all places other than metro type of areas have the ability to keep their economy going and get somebody fuel if they need it?
Madam Chair, Representative Vile, I can give you two answers to that one, the philosophical argument and then the practical argument. Politics is the art of the possible, and what we are trying to do is limit this to something that actually works and does serve a good portion of the state that needs it. We realize there are isolated areas of the state, some in Western Oregon, some other places, that may still have issues with fuel availability. We know as a general fact that Eastern Oregon, outside of the three counties, has large segments of territory that aren't covered by fueling stations. So really what we did is try and put together something that was practical, that was took into account all types of concerns, including labor concerns, including, you know, what happens to people who just pull up, and we're allowing for people to pick a station during the daylight hours, basically 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. If it's got a convenience store or something like that, there'll be somebody there to pump gas for you. We're trying to basically see what works. Last 2 years ago, we tried just 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. And what we found was that wasn't really enough to keep some of these stations open. We also heard that we sort of went a little bit too far, frankly, with some of the coastal stuff. And while we're not trying to pull back anything on the coast, we realized that going to Eastern Oregon was a very practical way to move this thing forward. Sometimes at the legislature, you work with all types of people, and I've had the privilege of working with most everybody on this committee, and you come up with what is practical and what will pass.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Helpful for a freshman to hear that explanation.
Representative Benson.
Chair, one other thing, and I just want to go to this this slide. I don't have this slide back on it. The studies show that the cost of fuel in states that don't have that allow self-serve is 5 to 6 cents a gallon less than here. We are trying to pass, or we hope to try to pass, a transportation package. It will include a gas tax increase if it passes. To the extent that we can assist in lowering the cost of fuel, it will help us in our arguments to obtain more money for our roads. This is not a challenge as a conversation in Eastern Oregon as it perhaps may be over here, but this is, that would be on folks in the Willamette Valley to sort out. In my area, it's clear as a bell that the price of fuel in Idaho is 4 to 5 cents cheaper every day than in Oregon. That's why right across the river from Little Ontario, in a little town called Fruitland, Idaho, it has one station less than Ontario. It has 7 stations with half as many people. So we know what's happening. Everybody's driving into Idaho and buying their gas because of that nickel difference. We've kept track over the last couple of weeks, and consistently there's a 2 to 4 cent difference lower on the Idaho side. So what I'm saying is, it's damaging to those of us on the border. I think it's going to turn into an argument when we turn our attention to the transportation package later in this session. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Evans.
I have a lot of respect for folks that are fighting it out along the border with other states where they can offer all kinds of things. Some of us don't live on the border area, and some of us actually have less faith in where the real savings might be found, given the profits of certain industries that fuel the small companies that are trying to balance out the availability of gas from companies that provide the gas. So here's my comment on this. I voted for this last time because I recognize that anybody in need, in the dark, that was stranded should never feel stranded or at need just because of where they happen to be living. And I'm with you on this amendment. I'm going to vote yes for the bill because I want to make sure that people aren't stranded, and I think that there's a standard of expectation living in an organized state. At the point that it pivots to statewide self-service, that's an entirely different issue, and I just want to put that on the record.
Vice Chair Meek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. Wasn't around when this was passed, 2014, is that right? Section 2 here of the amendment, the Dash 3 amendment, is Curry, Clatsop, and Tillamook County currently able to have a self-dispenser in the evening hours?
Madam Chair, Representative Meek, when I first saw this amendment, I sort of panicked, like, what's he doing? But it's just sort of backwards drafting. What Section 3 or Section 2 is, the one that deals with the coast, is current law. What Section 1 is basically current law modified for Eastern Oregon. So there is, it's exactly on the coast, it's exactly as it was passed in 2015. There's no change whatsoever, and that was intentional. But again, I had the same panic when I looked at it and went, oh my gosh, what have they done? And no.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the clarification.
Any other questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to comment on this particular bill that we have before us? We don't have anyone else on the list. All right, speak now or forever hold your peace. Then we are open for a public hearing and possible work session. We'll go ahead and work this bill. Vice Chair Meek.
Chair McEwen, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments dated 2/28/17.
Vice Chair Meek moves to adopt the Dash 3 amendments dated 2/28/2017. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted.
Chair McEwen, I move House Bill 2482 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Meek moves House Bill 2482 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I'm going to be a no on the bill. We just saw the map of Oregon. And my district is surrounded virtually by self-serve gasoline. Two sides from the coastal communities and the other two sides by the state of Washington. I'm opposed to self-service gasoline. I understand that there are problems in Eastern Oregon, and I am more than willing to try and accommodate our good friends in Eastern Oregon to overcome their problems. I'm very sympathetic to the problems that they have, but self-serve gasoline has now surrounded my district, and that's creating problems for me. I'm going to be a no on the bill.
Thank you, sir. Any further discussion? Yes, Representative McLean.
I'm going to be voting yes on this, but I don't think it's as clear-cut as necessarily that map shows it, because I agree with Representative Witt that once it's sort of like, you know, the slippery slope or the camel's nose under the tent kind of an issue. And I really didn't hear from Eastern Oregon folks and people who actually have their own gas stations that it was that clean and clear, that there were some of them that found that it was too expensive to put in the equipment they needed, and some others felt like they would prefer to be with the older model. But I feel like this is a compromise. I feel like it's done what it needs to do, and I want to support Eastern Oregon and Representative Bentz as far as really bringing something home to what he believes is the majority of what his citizens are really looking for in the way of safety and service and being able to deal with some of these issues when there are such long distances between stations. But I want to thank the chair and everyone else who's been working for that compromise in the last couple of weeks.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Wilson, we are Right in the middle of voting, we have accepted the amendments, the dash 3 amendment on House Bill, where's my number, 2482, which is the self-serve gas issue over in Eastern Oregon that Representative Benz has brought to us.
Yes.
So we have now adopted the dash 3 and are ready to vote on the bill.
Okay.
Do you have comments to make, sir?
No, I don't.
All right, you ready to go?
Yep.
All right, Vice Chair Meek.
We already did that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, we are. Is there any further discussion? That's where we are. Any further discussion? Seeing none, Clerk, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Barreto.
Aye.
Representative Evans.
Yes.
Representative McLean.
Aye.
Representative Noble.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
No.
Representative Meek.
Aye.
Representative
Vile.
Aye.
Chair McKeown.
Aye. The motion carries. I'm going to make an assumption. Representative Benz, would you like to carry this bill?
Thank you,
sir.
Of course.
Okay. Thank you, sir. So, Tim, if you would note that. And I am going to close our public hearing and work session on House Bill 2482. And I'm going to turn to Vice Chair Meek. I do need to step out and go testify in another hearing room just for a few brief moments. And I'm going to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Meek to open our informational hearing on transit. So I will return shortly, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, good morning. We're going to now open up the informational meeting for Tri-County Metropolitan Transportation District of Oregon.
Coos County Area Transit and Rogue Valley.
Okay, yes, and also the Coos County Area Transit and Rogue Valley Transit District. Welcome to the dais.
Well, good morning, Vice Chair Meek and members of the committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity for me and my colleagues to join you here this morning. I'm Neil McFarland. I'm the general manager of TriMet in Portland, Oregon. And I'm really pleased to be able to have the chance to talk a little bit about TriMet and some of the challenges that we face in serving our population in the Portland metropolitan area. And I know I'll be joined by our colleagues statewide, which will also share some of those challenges. I'm going to have Aaron Dees from TriMet run the PowerPoint, given my age and inability to handle technology. But I thought I'd first review a little bit about, first of all, I'd like to divide my presentation into five parts. First, a quick review of TriMet's mission and duties. Second, our ridership and our performance. Third, a little bit about our financial situation. And fourth, about the challenges that we face as our region grows and as our demographics change. And fifth, finally, talk a little bit about how we can work with you, the legislature, in effectively addressing some of those challenges. So let me quickly review our mission and duties. We talk about our role in life as having really four major missions. First, to connect people to jobs, shopping, and services, to cost-effectively reduce congestion during the peak hours, to provide affordable and responsive services to seniors, people with disabilities, youth, and low-income residents of our district. And fourth, to help shape regional growth according to the plans established by our local governments and regional agency. In doing that, we say that we have two duties. One, we must be fiscally responsible and prudent. And second, we must ensure that our employees, our customers, and general public have a safe and high-quality experience on our system. So we do those roles and duties by serving 100 million trips a year, actually 310,000 trips every day.
We like to say we move a city every day. We're the 24th largest metropolitan area in the area we serve, but we're number 9 in the nation in per capita ridership. So a lot of people say we outbox our weight class. 12 million of our annual trips are by seniors and people with disabilities, including about 1 million of those trips on our Lyft paratransit program. And we're very proud of our leadership and our fleet of accessible low-floor and light rail vehicles. 45% of downtown Portland commuters use transit to get to work. And we carry 1 in 3 commuters along the Banfield and the Sunset Highways every day. All told, we eliminate approximately 200,000 auto trips from our system. And given the congestion we're facing, one doesn't have to think very hard about what another 200,000 trips would mean to congestion in Portland. To remind you, TriMet is governed by a 7-member board of directors that's appointed by the governor and approved by the state Senate. Each member of the board represents a geographic district of the region. And we're very proud of the work the governor and the Senate has done in selecting really a very diverse and professional board of directors. On our board, we have members from all walks of life. We have a retired electrician. We have the senior pastor of the Maranatha Church, a retired community college president, small business owner and entrepreneur, the former director of land use and transportation for Washington County and the Oregon Economic Development Department, and a former city manager. I believe they've done a great job of balancing the need to be fiscally prudent with the desire to serve our community and expand service. They've not been parochial when they look at their districts, but rather look at what's best for the overall health of the region and the transit system. And the successful stewardship of the agency can be seen in the next couple of slides. One way we measure our performance is to compare ourselves to our peers. Systems such as Salt Lake City, San Diego, Denver, Dallas. And so when we look at these similar population centers with similar fleet sizes, we find that TriMet does extraordinarily well on what are kind of standard measures of performance within our industry. Number one, in 2014, which is the last year for which we have consistent data from the federal government, we were number one in per capita rides. We were number 3 in boarding rides per vehicle hour. We were number 6 in operating expense per vehicle hour. We were number 2 in passenger revenue per boarding ride, and number 2 in fare recovery ratios. And you note that we've actually improved from 2012 to 2014. We were moving in the right direction. I'd also just note that I'd like to highlight some of the financial performance of the agency. Last year, Moody and Standard & Poor's gave TriMet their highest bond rating, AAA. TriMet was the first transit agency of its kind to receive this AAA rating, and this was actually reaffirmed by these agencies last month. We achieved this high rating by pursuing deliberate steps to address long-term costs, closing, for example, defined benefit pension programs, renegotiating our collective bargaining agreement, and aggressively funding our pension trust. In 2014, our board adopted a strategic financial plan that memorialized our very conservative policies around debt and spending. For example, the policy limits on borrowing limit us to 6% of our annual revenues in terms of debt service. And so that's what led to this increase in our rating. And so I think it's fair to say that we're managing our finances quite well. One of the things I did want to begin to turn to are the challenges that we face as a metropolitan area and a metropolitan transit system. This isn't actually an eye test, but it is to represent that our vibrant, growing economy is a very good thing. But it also has a flip side, which is population and employment growth. We have a lot of people from around the country coming to Portland to take advantage of the great environment and the economic opportunities we've created. We expect that the Portland region is expected to see 400,000 new residents by 2035. Hence this chart. That's four times the population of the city of Hillsborough. And then that also comes with an additional 260,000 jobs. And we know from the Portland Business Alliance cost of congestion study that those new residents and new jobs mean more travel, more freight movement, more demands on the existing system, and more congestion. That scale of growth is projected to result in almost 50% more car trips and 75% more freight trips by 2040. And that could mean a threefold increase in congestion over today. If not addressed, that level of congestion will cost the region jobs and income. But we can reduce the expected growth in congestion if we invest in our regional transportation plan. In fact, the Portland Business Alliance study shows that for every dollar we invest in transportation, we'll see economic benefits of $2.40. So another challenge we face is changing demographics in the region. If you think back about 20 years ago, a significant portion of our region's minority and low-income population lived in a fairly compact area of North Portland, Northeast Portland, and Inner Southeast Portland. And they had the benefit of really good transit service within those areas. Today, because of gentrification and increasing housing prices in close-in neighborhoods, the minority and low-income population of the region have dispersed to areas such as Far East Portland, Gresham, Alloa, Outer Beaverton, areas that, frankly, have not been as traditionally well-served by transit. So we face the challenge of retooling our thinking and retooling our transit system to serve these more dispersed populations. And over the last 2 years, we've engaged with the community in a conversation about that question, and that's resulted in a series of service enhancement plans, as we've called them, for the five major areas of our region. This is particularly focused on bus service and how to actually increase and improve bus service within each of these communities. And this would be an appropriate time for me also to thank this committee and the legislature for action in 2009 that actually granted TriMet the authority to increase its payroll tax rate by 0.1%. We worked in 2014 with our business community, who I'm also very grateful for their help and support, to actually implement that, which was an action taken by our board in late 2014, and beginning a 10-year ramp-up of 0.1% over a 10-year phase-in for that service, increase. And that has also allowed us, that is what really has allowed us to begin to improve service. And we're actually on a path of increasing service now twice a year within our district. That allows us to address congestion, overcrowding on our system, as well as providing service to new areas with new routes. We also are using the revenues to begin to develop some improved projects that will help us achieve, again, the congestion reduction goals of our region. One is the Division Transit Project, and this is a new model for us, although Lane and other transit districts Lane Transit has used this technique as well. And it's currently in the design phase. It will take one of our most heavily used routes, our number 4, and turn it into a much more robust transit service. The line 4 currently serves about 9,000 rides a day. But the project will use articulated low-floor buses and strategies for moving through congested areas such as queue jump lanes, signal priority, and level boarding. And that will also be enhanced by additional pedestrian improvement along Division, where in many areas there are currently no sidewalks. So this 14-mile, 40-station project is projected to cost about $175 million, with about $100 million of that coming from federal Small Starts funds. And service is expected to start in 2021. The other major project I wanted to just touch on is the Southwest Corridor. And as you well know, one of the region's toughest congestion problems, is I-5 and the bottlenecks along Barber Boulevard and on the Terwilliger Curve. The Southwest Corridor is indeed one of our fastest growing and most economically vibrant in our region. This is the area between Portland State University and Tualatin. It's home to 240,000 residents, 98,000 jobs, and it's projected to grow by another 75,000 residents by 2035. And that's equivalent to adding a city the size of Bend to this existing area. It's also a very mobile corridor. Each morning, nearly 85,000 workers flow into the corridor for work and nearly 50,000 out of the corridor for work. As I noted, anybody who drives a stretch of I-5 knows that this is a problem. And here's the challenge, is that there are really only two travel options through this area, Barber Boulevard and I-5. Both are heavily constrained by the topography and the river. So that's why light rail has been selected as a great alternative to carry large amounts of people in this corridor and to help relieve the congestion. Indeed, our projections show that light rail will carry 25% of peak hour commuters in the I-5 corridor. And this proposed new line will connect PSU, OHSU, Portland Community College, Sylvania, Tigard and Bridgeport Village in the south. The line is expected to have a ridership of about 35,000 per day when completed and provide the equivalent capacity of 2.5 lanes of highway in each direction. And it's worth noting that these projects don't just build light rail. They become places of major investment in the community. So they rebuild roadways, bridges, other aging infrastructure like water and sewer lines, and add amenities like sidewalks and bike facilities that never existed before. And we certainly saw this with the Orange Line that we completed and opened in 2015, by the time, on under budget. And it's been a great success in terms of the ability to develop ridership, see development along it, and additional stream restoration, rail crossing, sidewalks, and bike facilities, also part of that project. And we think we can have the same kind of positive impact in the Southwest Corridor. By the way, our funding, if our funding efforts are successful, construction will start in 2021, and we expect this to generate 21,000 jobs during its construction period. Now, I've talked a lot about TriMet, and I'd like to take just a minute to talk about the broader transportation issues in the metropolitan area. TriMet is not an island. We function well when the broader transportation system functions well. And we know that to respond to the demands of growth, to mitigate congestion, and to meet our clean air goals, we need to invest in both better transit, better bike and pedestrian facilities, and better roads, including regionally significant traffic bottlenecks on highways and freeways. I would contend, and I think there's growing consensus about this, that the worst of these congested bottlenecks include Highway 217, I-205 between the Abernathy Bridge and I-5, and also the I-5 interchange in the Rose Quarter area. We all experience these. These are the red and orange spots on our mental maps of the freeway system in Portland, and we all know that they need to be improved. We also know that these are very big projects, and we know that not one level of government, state, regional, or federal, will be able to fund them all by itself. It's going to take a cooperative effort and some funding from all levels of government to see these much-needed improvements take place. As I noted, I'm happy to say that I believe we're seeing a regional and statewide consensus about the importance of implementing these four projects as a package. And I think that's really positive. So, as I say, no one level of government will be able to accomplish all of these projects by itself. But we need to begin to put the pieces of a partnership together, and together we can make them happen. The region put the first piece of this puzzle in place by allocating resources to actually develop these bottleneck projects. The next piece of the puzzle we hope can be a robust state transportation package that's large enough to meet the maintenance and preservation needs that are so pressing, but also to fund some enhancement of the system to make a significant down payment on these three major bottleneck projects. We also hope the legislature will partner with us with the region on this new light rail line, as it has done on a number of other light rail projects in the past. With those state contributions in hand, the region expects to leverage those funds many times over. If we're successful in adopting a robust funding package that addresses half or more of the cost of these projects, we expect to move forward with a funding request of our voters in the region to match those state funds. With those resources in hand, we expect to do, as we have many times before, and secure federal light rail funds and potentially fast lane matching funds from the federal government. This partnership strategy holds the promise of multiplying the impact of state dollars many times over. So what we have is a bold and difficult strategy, and we know that it won't be easily achieved. But I am optimistic about it for two reasons. First of all, we've done this before. If one begins to think about the Banfield or the Highway 26 corridors, they were both developed jointly with light rail and highway improvements. So we have a track record of success, frankly, is the envy of many regions around the country. And second, I don't believe we have a practical alternative. We are a growing region. We're incredibly successful because of that. But that price of that success is that more people are coming to enjoy what our state has to offer. While that's good, it also means we have to step up to the task of growing the transportation system to meet that challenge. And with your leadership and help, I'm confident we can do that. And I'd, at the appropriate time, to be happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair and Madam Chair.
Chair.
I'm questions and discussion. Yes, sir. Vice Chair Meek. Or I'm sorry, Vice Chair Vile.
Madam Chair, Neil, thanks for coming and taking the time to give us, I think, a very informational presentation. I do have a few questions. It's been about a year, just because of other things that have happened in my life, but I used to ride from Beaverton Transit out to the airport frequently. I live in Shoals, so I drive my car over to the Beaverton Transit Center, cost me a couple of bucks. Cost me a couple bucks to get on the train and ride out to the airport. Do you have any idea what the actual cost to the system for me to ride that train from Beaverton to the airport is?
I can give you an average, and this is pulling from a faded data bank, but on average, your fare is covering about 40 to 45% of light rail operations costs. And I would also say that that's a higher proportion for light rail than it is if you were riding a bus the same distance as in a general average. So, again, light rail has some efficiencies given its size with one operator. Fixed guideway moves quicker through this, is a bit congestion-proof. So the cost per rider is actually lower, substantially lower on light rail than it is on our bus system as an average.
And has a study ever been done to determine what effect on ridership it would have if we came to par on cost per rider?
I don't know that I have a specific reference to that. I would only hazard to say that the ridership is price sensitive. We've been able to hold fares constant now for 5 years, and I think that's been helpful to our residents. But again, I think you would see a dramatic reduction in price, in ridership.
One of the things I didn't hear, follow-up, thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things I didn't hear in your presentation was any discussion funding-wise of using private partnership, private-public partnership, P3 kind of transactions. Whether it were setting fares at par or tolling on highways or whatever that funding mechanism might be, is there a reason why we're not hearing that as part of the TriMet analysis of how to get things like roads. You said we need roads as well as some of these other alternatives. Is there a reason why that hasn't been discussed?
Well, let me just address that on the transit side. And what I would indicate is that TriMet actually has been a leader in public-private partnerships. And if you look at our red line that you rode to the airport, was actually the product of a public-private partnership. In that case, we partnered with a private entity that actually, in exchange for a lease on, frankly, underused public land near the airport that they later developed and got a revenue stream off, were able to contribute substantially to the cost of that project. It still took additional dollars from the City of Portland, TriMet, and the region to actually make that a reality. I think the truth is that overall, there are also some really good public-private partnerships in the transit world, but they've all relied very heavily on the sort of operating subsidy from the public agency, as well as oftentimes, as you say, toll revenues are another revenue stream that allows the capital cost to be paid off. Denver has recently opened a project that went from its Union Station to the airport. It's a little bit troubled right now in terms of its operation, but again, it's heavily subsidized by, in that case, RTD, in terms of its operation, getting to that question.
One final
follow-up. Sir, and then we'll probably need to move along.
Thank you. In your opinion, with the Southwest Corridor, 217, Abernathy, Rose Quarter, let's say we had those four projects that we were able to do, would the congestion on I-5 and 205 be relieved?
I would, in my opinion, it would be lessened. It would not be totally relieved. These projects, I think, are very much about balance. In order to sort of keep that balance, both a strong transit system that provides an alternative as well as the removal of these bottlenecks are, I believe, key to that suggestion. So, again, I don't believe there's a silver bullet to congestion. But, again, I think it would give us the tools to manage it, I think, as we have in some in many other quarters.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Witt, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious whether you presented a number of performance indicators, and I'm wondering if Moody's rates your success in human resources at TriMet?
Well, certainly they consider the overall health of the agency, including its long-term sort of commitments to both benefits as well as salaries. And also looks at our financial policies and how we've been able to adhere to them over history. So, yes, they are looking at HR and those related costs as it filters down to the overall bottom line to the agency.
Yes, sir.
Can you share with us Moody's comments?
We can share with you and certainly can get to you their rating report, and perhaps that would answer your question. I'd feel like I couldn't pull out those specific quotes that would be adequate to answer your question.
And, sir, if you would provide them for the committee, Tim will get them dispersed to us.
Happy to do that.
And as general manager, do you do your own in-house assessment of your human resources?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
The reason, Madam Chair, that I ask is, with the exception of a titanium manufacturer in Albany, I get the most complaints year after year after year about TriMet's human resources. And so it's not just an issue that crops up on occasion, maybe a collective bargaining agreement or something else that could blow things up. This is consistently for over a decade now. So I would be interested if anyone from TriMet would want to visit my office and explain to me what your plans are for improving your human resources going forward.
We'd be happy to do that.
Sir, Representative Meek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McFarland, a question about your governance structure.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that part of that governance structure that some of those members should be riders. And, you know, it just seems odd. Is the TriMet looking at a potential restructuring of that to include actual riders that are in the population and some more inclusivity to get feedback?
I would tell you that a good number of our board members are regular riders, including the president. And I'd also would note that I think, for example, Dr. T. Allen Bethel, who represents Northeast Portland, is also a regular rider and, you know, obviously is very much in touch with his congregation. So I think that influence is very strong on the TriMet board right now. Again, in terms of the membership, it's that's a matter for the governor and the state senate to, and I think they've done a very good job of bringing both a very diverse set of backgrounds that have both business and, if you will, social issues balanced within the membership of the board, and they're a very diverse group of people as well.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Thank you,
Madam McClain.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate the update, and I thought the information was very informative. I do want to kind of tag on to something Representative Vial said, and he keeps talking about you know, dealing with fares on par. And so if we're going to, you know, get that kind of information, I think it's really important that you add in there, you know, how much we are saving getting 35,000 cars off the road for, like, the Southwest Corridor, or how many actual cars we've gotten off the road for some of the other lines. Because to me, you know, again, if we're going to have a balanced system and we're going to understand what that fare represents, then it's going to be important for us to look at some of the other pluses that we get from just having a system that has both cars, buses, and trains. And also dealing with the fact that we are looking to stop choke points or congestion points in that Portland metropolitan area, because it affects the whole state.
Yep.
And so I think some of that has got to be added into the equivalence of what that fare means. So if you're going to do that work, please add that component.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Barreto, did you?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just tying into a couple of the things that were said here, you said you haven't increased rates in 5 years?
That's correct.
Okay, follow up on
yes,
that.
Yes, sir.
So your costs have gone up, though, I would assume, and if we can't raise the rates, then this will continue to be more expensive. Everything else in life is going up around us, including the cost of cars. And so it seems like this should follow that same pattern. And then, and you can comment on that, but then one other thing you said was for every dollar you invest, you get $2.42 ROI. So if you could kind of explain that model you have too.
You bet. Thank you, Representative. Just related to the rates, one of the sort of features of public transit is we do need to ask people occasionally to pay when they come in the door. And so right now our average adult fare is $2.50. It's a nice round number, so there's some ease of that. We've also been in an era of relatively low inflation. That's why we've been able to hold this. Frankly, we had a very large increase in 2011, and so that was about a 35-cent increase all at once. So we've been, if you will, recognizing that one large increase that came as a result of the revenue dips during the Great Recession, and I'm sure you all remember, we've been holding it since then. But we do have the plan. We do have as a policy to generally keep the rates in line with inflation. That would be the board general policy. I might also note that we're transitioning this next year to an electronic fare system where it will be sort of tap and pay with a lot of you know, app and website and telephone ability to load a card with values. So we expect that to really help reduce that pain, if you will, of having $2.50 in your pocket for the occasional rider. I think right now, as we noted, we actually are above average for the industry in terms of our fare box recovery, the share of costs paid by our riders. But our board is generally committed to keeping it at that level or above. Related to the ROI, that's a number that's borrowed from the Portland Business Alliance's cost of congestion study. that return on investment really includes the economic impact of freight being able to move at a reasonable rate, the reduced time people spend in vehicles. Obviously, congestion is a drag on the economy. It's an inefficient time. So removing that inefficiency or improving the efficiency of the transportation system reduces costs overall in the whole chain of freight and frankly, people movement. So that's the primary return on investment that this study looks at.
Thank you,
ladies and gentlemen. In the spirit of making sure that everyone has equal time to present their information that we've invited them here to do, I'd like to get moving. I think Vice Chair Meek has a very quick question follow up for TriMet, and then we really do need to move on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Pardon me, but yeah, I just would like to find out. Can you get us some details? It seems like you were talking about the availability of our services for our folks that are at very low incomes, and talking about serving the Eastern Portland and area out to Gresham. Do you have any numbers of what the average income is of our majority of our riders?
Yes, we do, and we can get that information.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Vice Chair Meek. I am delighted to have Rebecca Jennings here today. When we decided to do an informational hearing on transit for our seven new members of our transportation committee, I wanted to give this a very balanced approach. So we have TriMet and we have CCAT. And Rebecca, thank you for driving up from Coos Bay to talk a little bit about what you're doing down in my area. And then we have kind of the modest approach with Rogue Valley Transit. We have a little bit of everything here today. And Julie, thank you for being here as well. Welcome to our committee.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Madam Chair, representatives. It's an honor to be here. And we are on completely the other side of the area.
This is the alpha and the omega
yes,
of transit is what we
is.
Have here today.
Go ahead. So just a little bit of a history. We were originally operated by the Coos Curry Council of Governments, and when that failed, a transit study was done. And we became a component in 2004 of Coos County because insurance rates increased. So instead of paying $4,000 a year for liability insurance, it was increased to $47,000 a year. And so being able to form a service district, a non-taxing service district, that decreased the amount of insurance that we had to pay to keep on the road. Who we serve, basically what all the other transit agencies serve, senior citizens, people with disabilities, the general population. We transported around a little over $49,000 populations public last year. And we do this by, we have two fixed routes. We have an east and west. Coos Bay, North Bend is kind of in a V. So one route goes west towards the ocean, the other goes towards the city, the east. We also transport rural areas around us, Coquille, Myrtle Point, Lakeside, Hauser, and then we have a dial-a-ride service or our paratransit service that the general public in order to operate that service, it's basically paratransit. We don't have a whole lot of room for the general public to use our dial-a-ride service. Currently our funding is a little over $700,000, with 90% of that being federal and state grants, and the rest is fare capture, local grants from the cities, hospitals in the area, and bus advertising. Some of the challenges that we face is we have a higher percentage of seniors, people with disabilities, and lower income for Coos County. And that can be really challenging as far as we actually need another fixed route in our area because one of the barriers to that is we start at 8:15 in the morning and we finish at 4:30. So someone that is needing to get to even an 8 to 5 job is unable to use transit in Coos County. I was in a vehicle accident last August to where someone ran a red light and T-boned me, completely totaling my vehicle. Thankfully, not completely totaling me. First time I'd ever experienced an airbag deployment. I was not even able to use my transit agency to get to and from work. With our current funding, we just cannot extend those hours. So, and then another a barrier to us is the fact that we, with our dial-a-ride demand response service, we stay within the city limits of Coos Bay and North Bend, and then also of Coquille, Myrtle Point, and Bandon. What we have, for example, a town called Lakeside. It's 11 miles from Coos Bay. There is a gentleman there that is a dialysis patient that is not on the Oregon Health Plan. He doesn't qualify. And he had $40,000 worth of his life savings from retirement. He has completely went through that $40,000, paying $300 a week back and forth just to get between Lakeside and Coos Bay for kidney dialysis. We have other people.
Taxi service?
He cannot use a taxi service because he is wheelchair dependent. So he is using an ambulance service.
Oh my gosh!
Which
we need to fix that.
$90 a day, 3 days a week. And then we are able to, in the cities of Coos Bay and North Bend, have the privilege of transporting, especially wheelchair-dependent clients, to dialysis or other essential services. Mm-hmm. But our paratransit is maxed out. We have three that operate within Coos Bay and North Bend, and they're completely full. And we allow scheduling up to 2 weeks in advance, and it is full 2 weeks in advance. And this is just for the essential services. This is not grocery shopping, medical, counseling services, anything that someone needs. We don't put restrictions on what they can use paratransit for, just if you qualify under, if you're unable to access the fixed routes. However, with additional funding, say we were able to receive $200,000 more a year, we could expand the fixed routes 2 hours on each side, so transporting people from, say, like 6:30 to 6:30 at night.
That would be amazing.
That would, with community involvement and talking with the community, that would increase our ridership trifold, because people simply can't use our public transit system to get to and from work. Sometimes they'll use a taxi one way, and they're able to use our system to get back home. It would also allow us to serve those outlying communities. We could drive the 11 miles to pick up a dialysis patient before they go through their entire life savings. There are other smaller communities, like, for example, Coquille and Myrtle Point. We offer an inner city connection. It will leave in the morning, come to Coos Bay, North Bend. You are there for the entire day before we can have that return ride happen. Additional funding would allow people to have a midday run. So people that are having some physical trouble, or if they have medical rides, as opposed to coming to the Bay Area to visit dialysis or Bay Area hospital or wherever they need to go, only staying 2 to 3 hours and then being able to get back to home is highly impactful to them. They won't have to spend their whole day in a city that they're not feeling well anyway. So they just really need to get back home. I really want to do what I can. For example, this week alone, I have dispatched. I have gotten to a transit vehicle. When a driver called in sick, we don't have the funding for additional drivers right now. And so I get to connect with our ridership, both on the phone and driving. But what we could do We need to connect people to jobs and to medical services and other essential services. So the fact that you're working on this funding package is just simply amazing. I thank all of you for serving and for just doing what you do to help us.
Well, I think this shows the juxtaposition between urban and rural when it comes to transit. And I appreciate your acknowledgement. What I hear is the difficulty people have that do shift work in getting to work and getting home.
Yes.
And if you're a minimum wage employee, of which we have many, we are a very poor community. We are a very elderly community. A lot of our elders don't drive. So, and for them, moving around during the day is not so problematic. But for people who are doing shift work at our largest employers, which are 24/7 operations, if they can catch the bus to work but not home, it's an $8 cab ride one way. If you're a minimum wage worker spending $8 a day, 5 days a week, to transport yourself one way or the other from employment, it's very, very problematic. And so I take to heart the issues that you bring to us in rural communities, and I think you are representative of many of our rural transit providers. And the issue of medical transit, when I was first elected, I heard a horror story, and which is part of the reason we pulled together a local transportation work group. We had a medical patient who needed medical services that were not provided in Coos Bay. And for about 3 years, 5 days a week, that individual was transported from Coos Bay to Eugene and back for a medical service every day, 5 days a week. We spent $250,000 on that one patient. Yes. Because a service wasn't provided in our county that they needed. We immediately fixed that. When we actually just pulled a group together and said, how do we deal with this? And we pulled together the county health department and our local CCO and our providers and tried to figure how we solved it very quickly. Once we figured out that this was not tough, we just needed to have somebody thinking about it. I think Julie remembers this conversation. Yes. So there are issues that we need to focus on to solve, and no matter how we spend our money well, but also how we provide services to people who truly need them. The one thing you touched on briefly, but is our community college. We have students who need to get to the community college who live in our outlying rural communities. They're 20, 30, 10, 12 miles away. They don't have money for gas. They don't have cars. So to get them in to take classes so we can move them through to that associate's degree so that they can do what they need to do to get, you know, a higher level of employment is really important. But the transportation piece is the key.
It is.
And so I appreciate you coming in and helping enlighten us about the challenges that you face as a rural provider.
Thank you.
Any other questions for this witness? All right. Ms. Brown, thank you for being here today. So we've got the big, the little, and the in the middle.
Thank you.
Sure.
I'm not really good with technology, so.
Thank you, Erin. We appreciate your support.
That's right. So, Chair McEwen and community members, thank you for having me today. I'm going to be wearing two hats, and so I'm going to be jumping back and forth, and you'll have to forgive me. I'm representing the Rogue Valley Transportation District as a general manager, but I am also the president of the Oregon Transit Association. And so as we go through this, I'm going to be referencing some materials that I believe you have already, of a study that was done on 10 different agencies here in Oregon, and shows what the benefits to a transportation package would be for those areas. So the Oregon Transit Association really believes that we needed to tell our story better. Over the years, we've talked many times about transit and the need in the state, but we were never able to really pull together enough information that it really made sense. So we hired Frigginese and Associates to actually do this package for us, to do kind of a white paper study and find out what transit...
Need your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. forgive me, Julie Brown. I thought everybody knew who I was.
We do, but the people on TV and out there don't.
Sorry.
So.
Julie Brown.
You know the drill.
Transportation District, yes, and I got ahead of myself. Forgive me.
Thank you.
So what we did was we organized together as transit agencies, came up with a website. It's called bettertransitoregon.org. And please take a look at it when you get a chance. The idea was that we would be able to educate people, not only the legislators, but the general public, on what transit looks like in the state of Oregon. So this chart here is information from 2014 from an ASHTOS survey on funding, and it shows that, you know, although funding has started dipping in 2011, we got a higher level of funding because of the ARRA money that came through the federal government, and then that has dwindled down, and as you see, in 2012, we took this huge dip down when the money ran out, but the population keeps growing, and so the need is exceeding. And the funding is going down. And as Rebecca explained, they just took an 8% cut in elderly and disabled funding. That's a huge amount of money. And this is happening statewide. It's not just them. I don't even know what TriMet's number was, but it was significant. In this slide, in 2015, it shows that 16% of the state's population were over the age of 65. But by 2050, 23%. In the middle column, it shows Jackson County, where Rogue Valley Transit District sits. And if you look at that, 20.8% of the people in our county are over the age of 65. And I know I'm right on the heels of that, and will be demanding my benefit very soon of transportation. So this is a growing, and what we see happening is that by 2015, our 20.8% is going to jump a lot higher. So RVTD provides 1.5 million rides each year on our fixed route. It's not anywhere close to your 100 million, although I would want to have your problem in the Rogue Valley. 62%, and this is a survey we did in 2014, of our riders have no vehicle. They're transit dependent, and they're looking to us for their solution. Fortunately, it's not there. 66% of the riders make less than $15,000 per year in Jackson County. This slide is going to kind of put this into perspective. If RVTD, and this is a what if RVTD was part of this funding package and we received $3 million, I'm going to explain what that would mean. But this is the funding package overall shows that Oregon right now spends $8.03 per person towards transit. With a $100 million dollar package, and I think we're asking for a little bit more than that, we would be spending, and I think if you click on that, Aaron, it'll jump. Ah, nice graphic. $32.88. So that would move us to the top 25 in the nation. You know, it just shows that we're really... Presently, if you go backwards, we're really... Don't go backwards, because we'll... Or if you can, go ahead. But, nope, guess not.
There we go.
There. It shows that we're really low. We're right down in the bottom. There's only a few states below us. So this study was to kind of talk about the 10 different agencies. We tried to include a tribe, an urban, a medium urban, a large urban... some small urbans, and then some rural areas. And I would really encourage you to look at some of that information in the packet, because it really shows what the needs are across the state. And honestly, all of us have the same needs. It just looks a little bit different the way the service is provided. So those were the 10 agencies. And now I'm going to focus on Rogue Valley. So if you look on the right-hand side where it talks enhanced service, with that $3 million, that is our route fixture, route system now on the right-hand side. And we've put that yellow outline. This would increase to evening hours right now. We finish our routes at 6:30 and 7 o'clock at night. That's it. Bus stops. And unfortunately, when you're talking about shift work, we can get people to work on that second shift, can't get them home. Although, with this additional money, we'll be able to expand that service, and we might be able to address some of those problems. We are working privately with a lot of the companies like Harry and David to try to come up with solutions for their employees that work that middle shift, but we haven't quite got there yet. The yellow outlines that all of that would be increased on all of our routes, and we would also increase Saturday service. Today, this last May, our community voted in an additional property tax for 5 years to provide service that we had to cut. We cut 35% of our service, which included Saturdays. They brought it back. They voted it in, which I'm very grateful. But the service on Saturday starts at 8 a.m. and ends at 4, and it runs hourly. We're leaving people at the bus stops because we don't have enough capacity, and we really need to increase the frequency. So a lot of times people, the bus will pull up and we'll say, we're really sorry, but we can't put you on this vehicle. So we need to grow the system even more, and we just aren't able to do it. To give you an idea of what people in our community pay, 17 cents per millage on their property tax is our base, and they just voted in a 13% increase, or 13 cent, excuse me. I wish it was 13%, 13 cent. In addition to that $4 million, we would be able to put in an express route from Medford to Ashland. Right now, that route, if you get on in Medford, it takes you about 55 minutes to get to Ashland. The express route would be able to do it in a half hour. It would be, if we're on during peak times for people that are commuting to work. The route up in the Central Point area would hit areas that we aren't presently able to provide service levels at with a circular system, and then there was an also in the Ashland area circular system. This would add 410 more hours of service daily, and it would double what we're doing today. So when we did our route configuration and worked with Frigganese to actually put together this package, they used a software program that looked at demographics. It looked at the demographics of the Title VI demographics as far as low income, elderly, disabled. It took in housing. It also considered employment centers and special areas that would need additional housing. From that, what they accessed out of the software was 95% more jobs within 60 minutes from downtown Ashland. This would be access to, and access to 30% more jobs within the downtown Medford area. It would provide frequent transit to 8% more of the residents serviced by frequent transit, and it would provide 36% increase in total service hours for the district. And this last is that better transit, 37% increase in service statewide if we can get a transportation package. And we're working really hard with all of the rural areas to actually lift them up, and I want to thank my colleagues, especially TriMet. They've been really working with these small agencies to try to get this information out, because we know it needs to be statewide. It can't just be about our largest transit agencies. So thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Questions for this very knowledgeable panel? Yes, Vice Chair Meek.
Madam Chair, thank you. Just a quick question on your full statewide transit hat. What are your thoughts about the process that the city of Bend and that whole region is going through to kind of make that more of a region-wide transit system?
So, Madam Chair and Vice Chair Meek, I embrace that. I mean, I know what they're trying to do now is find a funding source, because they don't know that this transportation package is going to move forward. I think a regional transportation system for that area makes sense. It's been embraced regionally by the people there. I think that their approach is really a smart approach, because it's not just forcing it on everybody, it's bringing them along as they want to grow. And as if you've been to Bend, I was just shocked when I went about a year ago and went, where's Highway 97? It disappeared. You know, it is really expanding. So I think it's a great solution for them. I don't think that they'll ever be able to do the lift of becoming a transportation district like RVTD because of the regional area.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative McLean.
First of all, I really appreciate having all three of you here so that we can see the differences and the challenges and the different areas and the different sizes of the transit type of, you know, services that we have in the state of Oregon. And being part of the Joint Committee on Transportation, we are moving a package forward, right? And we are needing your support to help us do that. And I also want to be very clear, when you look back 20 years at where we were with transit 20, 25 years ago, even though we need more and we need to have it diversified across the state and with a variety of definitions for transit, think about how far we've come. And I remember a statement that was made 25 years ago, which we can't build our way out of congestion. And I think that's a statement we need to all take to heart, because we need that balanced transportation system that's talking about bikes and pathways and transit and roads and trying to help take care of those choke points that we have, you know, in the metropolitan area. But we need everybody. And the only way that we're going to be able to have that balanced system is basically by including and seeing a future for all parts of our balanced system. So thank you so much for your stick-it-to-iveness and also for your pioneer spirit, because truly it's taken every single portion of your energy, your abilities, and also just trying to really do the most with what you've got. And so thank you for both professionalism, but also for continuing to want to help us make that system balanced. Thank you.
Julie, I want to just kind of shine a light on one other thing that I talked about with Rebecca, and that's the collaborative way in which you approach the work that you have been doing down in your area in the last year, and the nexus between the community college was also a partner in your moving that levy forward. Could you talk a little bit, just really briefly, who all the partners were in making that happen? It truly was a remarkable feat.
Sure.
So toot your horn a little bit here.
Madam Chair, thank you. The first time that we went out on the ballot, we really failed miserably, 60-40, is trying to pass our measure for the property tax increase. And after that, we started rethinking what we were doing. And we met with the new superintendent of the Medford School District. And he came with a new idea. You know, he really embraced the idea of trying to move students in the high school system out to the college. The problem was the community college had moved out into the industrial area where land was cheap and service was not available. Getting those students back and forth was not something that was going to happen using a school bus and using that system. So they approached us and said, what if we started talking about this and supporting your measure? And the school board actually voted to support the ballot measure when we went out again. And we were able to work with the community college to design classes around a route that is specific to commuting out there, providing their students with transportation out to the community college. They also supported it kind of with a hands-off approach, because they were also on the ballot at the same time and didn't want to mess up their levy. But they have been instrumental in really promoting RVTD. We haven't really gotten it off the ground to the point that I would like to see the ridership just skyrocket, because they have to convince the students to actually start taking the classes out there. But it is great, because it's an opportunity for them to get some of the curriculum out of the way that they can move on to a higher education. And so we're thrilled about it. And the superintendent, sometimes I have to ask him to kind of calm down a little bit with what he's sharing with the community, because he's so over-exuberant about it.
Well, I would like to highlight that, because as a former school board chair and a college access professional, that when we passed the Senate bill that put expanded options into place where the state pays for college classes for high school kids, it changed the landscape in getting kids off with college credit, and the success rate goes up. And so I just want to highlight the fact that in Coos Bay we have the same issue with North Bend and Marshfield High School in Coquille. If you can get the kids to the college, they can graduate with credit. It saves them money out of their pocket when they go on to higher ed, and it benefits them in a higher graduation rate and this seamless transition from high school onto some type of post-secondary education, whether it's apprenticeship, community college, whatever it is. We all benefit in the long run, and this is a really key piece
piece of it when you talk about student transportation, and you're going to be hearing more about how transit needs to be integrated into the definition of student transportation in this state. We need to drag this into the 21st century and make sure that we're providing those opportunities and not creating roadblocks so kids aren't able to get those things done. And now I'll step off my soapbox from my former education work that I did. But there is a nexus here that's really important. So it's about seniors who don't drive. It's about individuals who choose not to have cars and use transit. But it's also about education. So I want to make sure we make that connection. Any other questions for this panel? Thank you for your indulgence. Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I think it's also about affordability, too, and what the state can afford right now. And on page 3, you had that the state spends right now $8.24 per person, and you wanted to get it up to $32.88, and you said then you'd be in the top 25%. But right now, Oregon population, we're right in the middle, I think at 27th, at 4 million. Our GDP at $228 billion, I think, is right in the middle. I think we're 27th. I think the amount of money we get back from the federal government is right about in the middle at 28th. And so Oregon is just right in the middle of the 50 states. But to take transportation and then, you know, try and pop it up to the top 25% of what is spent, unless if that's spent per capita. But even at that, it seems like we should be working within the boundaries of where Oregon's population and needs are. So I just wanted to mention that.
Thank you, Representative. Any other comments or questions for this panel? Thank you so much for traveling here today. We really appreciate it. We appreciate your expertise and your work.
Thank you.
We will close our informational hearing on transit and open an informational hearing on transportation funding. Mr. Brower, we're going to change gears here a bit. The reason I asked Mr. Brower to come and talk to us today, with seven new members on our committee, I just think it's important to kind of understand the fundamentals of how transportation funding works. So, Travis, take it away. Thank you for being here this morning.
You're very welcome, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Travis Brower. I'm the Assistant Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation, and I am going to give you essentially a transportation funding 101 overview. I'm going to start with talking about the major funding sources we have for transportation here in Oregon, talk a little bit about bonding, which is not so much a funding source as a financing mechanism, and then talk about some of the trends and issues we face within transportation funding. So we'll start with the major funding sources. We'll start at the federal level with the Federal Surface Transportation funding that we get from Uncle Sam back in Washington, D.C. Each year, Oregon receives about $500 million in federal highway formula funding. This comes from the federal gas tax primarily and the federal diesel tax on heavy trucks. This is funding that we use for capital projects in Oregon. We put this into our statewide transportation improvement program, or the STIP, as you may have heard of, and it is allocated by the Oregon Transportation Commission to projects. It cannot be used for basic maintenance activities like patching potholes, doing snow plowing, etc. This is largely a block grant that comes from the federal government, but it has a lot of strings attached. In fact, one of our folks referred to them as ropes more than strings. You essentially have to follow federal environmental processes, federal procurement requirements, as well as a whole variety of other federal requirements. So we find that ODOT is very experienced with using federal funds, but local governments sometimes struggle because of all the strings that come with it. This funding can be used for roads as well as bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure, and also for public transportation. So the Transportation Commission chooses to flex some of that to public transportation.
And Travis, is that apportioned in any way?
Yes, Madam Chair, it is apportioned. Do you mean to the state from the federal government?
Does the federal government tell you how much to spend on bike and pedestrian and transit and roads, or do you get to pick?
Chair McEwen, it is largely a block grant in which the Transportation Commission gets to determine how that money is allocated. There are some sort of minimum amounts that go to various places. For example, there's a bicycle and pedestrian program called the Transportation Alternatives Program. There's also minimum amounts that go to local governments through some programs. So it fairly broad authority in general.
Thank you.
So the good news about federal funding is it is going up now. Congress passed the FAST Act in late 2015 that provides slight increases in funding over time over the course of a five-year period through 2020. Slight increases are really exciting for us because previously, as you can see, we were actually having flat or declining funding for quite a number of years. So two cheers for slight increases in funding. One of the key parts of the federal program is that a lot of this is shared with local governments. As I mentioned, there are requirements in statute to share with local governments, but we go well beyond that. And so we give local governments funding for bridges and safety and for non-highway projects and also for access to federal lands. Local governments under the FAST Act did get a significant increase in funding. So they actually get about 30% of the total federal highway funding that comes to Oregon, probably one of the largest sources of federal money that goes to local governments. A lot of this, the largest category is what we call the Surface Transportation Program for Transportation Management Areas. That's a fancy way of saying the three largest metro areas in Oregon, Portland, Eugene, and Salem, get a statutorily directed share of the formula funding, and that went up significantly under the FAST Act. There is also a large amount of money that comes to Oregon for transit from the federal government. It's about $100 million per year. And this actually is not so much a block grant. It goes more directly to the providers. The largest single recipient is the Portland metro region, TriMet, and the Wilsonville area, which received close to $57 million in formula funding in last year. And then the other urban areas also get the bulk of the funds. The money for those grants goes directly to those areas, and then ODOT receives the funding for the rural areas and distributes it through a formula in coordination with the other funding that we get from the state.
Travis, I want to just, I'm sorry to sidetrack you, but I think there's a point to be made here, too. What I hear from the smaller transit providers is one of the things they have difficulty with is finding match money to get some of those federal dollars. Could you touch on that a little bit about the money we're leaving on the table at times?
Yeah, thanks, Chair McEwen. That's a really important point. All the federal money comes with matching requirements. And so on the highway side, it's only about 10% of the total project cost that you have to come up with as a local share. In the public transportation arena, though, it can be significantly higher. For those who are going to use the funding for operations costs, which is an allowable use of transit funding in the rural areas, it's about a 50-50 match. And so you have to come up with a lot more local funding in order to get that federal funding. And there are some providers who just really can't scrape that together if they don't have a tax base and perhaps they're relying on general funds in their area. So, yes, there are a number of local jurisdictions who really just can't make use of the federal funds as a result of that.
So it would be fair to say what Julie was talking about down in Medford and what they're trying to do up in the Bend-Redmond area would allow them to have the resources to match some of that federal money, but someone like CCAT really struggles trying to come up with that, so they leave money on the table.
Yes, absolutely, Chair McEwen. With additional state funding, it would allow all those transit providers to ensure they could make use of that funding that the federal government makes available.
Thank you, Travis.
So the second major source of funding is the State Highway Fund. This is the funding that comes from the state-level sources of gas tax, driver motor vehicle fees, and the weight mile tax. This can be used for either capital projects like the federal funding or maintenance of the system as well. So today, ODOT's share of the State Highway Fund is actually now really fully dedicated not to projects but to maintenance and operations of the system and agency operations, as well as the debt service that we have that I'll talk about a little bit later. So really, we're heavily reliant on federal funding for capital project construction going forward once the JTA projects wrap up. One of the features of the State Highway Fund that you'll hear about is the constitutional restriction. It's in Article 9, Section 3, which basically says that any revenue from motor fuels, taxes or fees, and any tax on the ownership operation of a motor vehicle goes into the State Highway Fund and can be used solely for highway purposes. Now, that includes construction, reconstruction, maintenance, and it also includes bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure within the highway right-of-way, because that's considered, you know, sidewalk or bike lane is actually considered part of the roadway. This ensures that all the money that the legislature raises from those fees and taxes goes into transportation. In some states that don't have this, you see large amounts that are put into other government functions. So the good news at the state level is that we have a very well-balanced revenue portfolio, unless, like the federal level, where about 85% of the money comes from fuel taxes. At the state level, we have the three major sources. Fuels tax is nearly half of that revenue, and then motor carrier taxes and fees, largely the weight mile tax on heavy trucks, and driver motor vehicle fees are a little bit over a quarter each. So this is good because it means that there's relative stability in the funding that we have. It's interesting to see that when we do comparisons across states, Oregon actually has one of the lower automobile-related taxes compared to western states. You can see that Washington is way the heck above this, us. They have a fuel tax now that's, I think, 49.5 cents per gallon compared to our 30. So a lot cheaper to fill up your car in Oregon. And, in fact, most of the other western states have much higher taxes and fees other than Montana. The main reason for that is this is a comparison of vehicle fees across the entire country. It's hard to read. We've compared the cost of paying the taxes on a Cadillac Escalade versus a Chevy Malibu. You can see Oregon is all the way on the right. That's because our title fee is $77, our registration fee is $43 a year, and we don't have a sales tax or other tax. You drive a car off the lot, it's relatively inexpensive. The other thing I take from this chart is do not buy an Escalade in either Colorado or Kansas because they will charge you up the wazoo for that privilege. So the State Highway Fund is actually a shared resource. It is not just money that goes to ODOT. You'll hear about 50-30-20. About half the money goes to ODOT, and 30% goes to counties, 20% goes to cities. That's actually, I think that is probably about the highest share going to local governments of any state in the nation. I've never found another state that is more generous than that. So that allows local governments to receive a pretty substantial amount of the funding. They do so under a formula. For counties, the money is distributed among counties, $243 million last year, based on the number of motor vehicles registered in the county. So it is not based on road ownership or any other measure of need, just based on the number of motor vehicles. So what you can see is Multnomah County gets received over $41 million, and Wheeler County a little short of $140,000. In the city's share, which is 20%, they got $164 million last year. It's distributed on population, so not, again, not based on road mileage or any other measure of need other than population. And so that amount ranges from $36 million in Portland to $1,186 for the lovely burg of Lone Rock in eastern Oregon. So quite a wide spread there.
Representative Barreto, is that in your district?
Lone Rock?
Is it in Wheeler County, Travis?
Representative McEwen, I believe that Representative Smith claims that town.
Ah, all right. Thank you. I just wanted to fair attribution.
The third major source of funding that we have for transportation is for non-highway modes, and that is the Connect Oregon Lottery-backed bond program. To date, the legislature has provided $427 million in funding for Connect Oregon through six rounds. As you can see, we started off with pretty robust funding back in the 2005 to 2009 periods, $100 million per biennium, and that's dropped a little bit in recent years. The governor's request budget had a little over $71 million for Connect Oregon requested in this upcoming biennium. Connect Oregon is used for the non-highway modes that you cannot fund out of the state highway fund. So that would include bicycle and pedestrian projects outside the highway right-of-way, as well as public transportation capital projects, as well as port, rail, marine, aviation infrastructure. We have, between our funding sources, really the ability to fund most any mode of transportation in Oregon because of Connect Oregon. But as you can see, the rail, ports, aviation, we have a more limited portfolio of sources to fund those. It's also fairly difficult to fund transit operations costs because you can use only a small portion of the federal funding for transit operations, and Connect Oregon cannot be used for operations costs. That's why there are a few miscellaneous sources of state funding for transportation. These all go to the non-highway modes, really pretty much passenger rail and public transportation. For passenger rail, we use the custom license plate fees, some of the money from the Transportation Operations Fund, which is, we call it the lawnmower fund, because when you fill up your lawnmower, technically that's not subject to the constitutional restriction because you're not using it on the road. At least I hope you're not using it on the road. And as a result, that money can go into non-highway modes. And we also use general fund for passenger
rail. Can you give
rail.
Us a sense of how much money is in there?
It's really just a few million dollars a year that goes to passenger rail and a few million dollars that goes to senior and disabled transportation. The lawnmower fund, identification card, cigarette tax, and general fund are also used. They go into what is called the special transportation fund for seniors and disabled transportation. Fairly limited amount of money again, and that is actually going down this coming biennium based on the current budget. Local governments also supplement the money they get from the federal government and the state highway fund with a number of sources. Quite a number have local gas taxes. Street utility fees are becoming popular. Property taxes are used. Multnomah County has a vehicle registration fee to pay for the Selwood Bridge. And then a lot of local governments use the system development charges. So that's your 101 course on funding sources. We'll talk a little bit about bonding now. Bonding's been used a lot in recent years to help front-load resources that are provided under transportation investment packages by the legislature. And much like a family takes out a mortgage, so you can buy a house a lot faster than if you had to save up the cash, we use bonding as a tool that allows you to build a lot more highway projects or transportation projects a lot sooner than you would if you had to save up the cash for that. And much like a mortgage, the key to bonding is really to keep the amount you're spending on debt service at a reasonable portion of your income. So ODOT's target is about no more than a third of our income from the state highway fund going out the door in debt service payments. And I mean, that's about the same level that people say is prudent for mortgages. That's where ODOT is right now. We've actually got a reasonable and prudent level of debt. And as a result, bond rating agencies have consistently given us very high ratings. We have a AAA from one of the agencies and a AA+ from two others. There is... important to note that ODOT does not undertake bonding on our own. Bonding is actually directed by the legislature in the transportation investment packages or other places. It has to be approved in the bonding bill, and the bonds are actually issued by the state treasurer's office, so that we are really a participant in this process but not the ones driving the ship. Right now, we have used bonding to really build a large number of projects very quickly. So we're in the midst of the Jobs and Transportation Act projects. We have about $2.7 billion in outstanding bonds. And the interest rate on these, just on the fixed rate bonds, is really phenomenal, 3.5% total cost of funds. It's actually lower if you include our variable interest rate bonds, some of which coming in under 1% interest rate, less than the rate of inflation. So we're really getting a pretty fantastic deal on those. It's also important to note that we take
Representative Bretto?
Yeah, thank you. How long are these bonds good for?
They are good for 25 years for the most part. So this chart shows you that most of these bonds are issued as 25-year debt paid off over that time. And so through 2036, we have about $200 million in debt service annually, and that will then drop off at that point.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to ask briefly, what did we do before bonding? Was it a pay-as-you-go system?
Chair McEwen, Representative Wilson, yes, before we had bonding, as you can see, back in before the OTIA program in 2001, we really were a pay-as-you-go state. So money would come in the door, and we'd pay for projects that way. So it was with the advent of OTIA in 2001, the legislature passed in 2001 and 2002, $500 million in bonded funding for projects, followed that up with OTIA 3, which was $1.9 billion, and then again the Jobs and Transportation Act was $840 million. So sort of layering on to that bonded debt.
Representative McLean.
And to that, Travis, I think you were indicating also that depending on how long the facility, if it's a bridge, is it longer than 25 years?
Yes. Chair McEwen, Representative McLean, we bond only for long-term capital assets. We do not bond for operations or maintenance. And we do take into account the type of project you're building because you want your asset to last longer than the life of the bonds. In fact, that's pretty much a legal requirement for bonding. So we are bonding for long-term capital projects, interchanges, bridges, et cetera, to ensure that they have a long life.
Any questions?
Please, thank you.
It's important to note, too, that just like any homeowner is going to look at their mortgage and see if they can get a better deal by refinancing, ODOT is constantly in the market looking to refund its debt. We've saved about $100 million in debt service payments over time through being able to manage and refund our debt as interest rates have gone lower. So let's talk now a little bit about some of the trends and issues we're seeing in the transportation funding world. One of the first and most important things for you to know is that over the last really 15 years, the legislature has provided a number of infusions of funding that have allowed ODOT and local governments to undertake quite a number of really important projects. We're now, though, at the point of finishing up the Jobs and Transportation Act funding or projects. We're finishing up the Newburgh-Dundee Bypass this year, finished up the Sunrise Corridor last year, finishing up many other of these projects, sort of on the downward slope of what we call this mountain chart. And as a result, by 2019, 2020, we'll actually have a program that is about the same size as before the legislature passed the first OTIA program if there's no additional investment. And that's even before factoring in inflation. If you factor in inflation, the buying power of our funding at that point will be much lower than it was in the past. Some of that is due because we have debt service that continues out for two decades. The legislature has authorized bonds that now total about $200 million in annual debt service payment. So every year from the revenue that we get in from the State Highway Fund, about $200 million will go out the door and can't be used for additional projects. Now, again, this is a reasonable and prudent level of debt, but it does constrain the funding we have going forward because essentially we've already built the projects using this money and are now just paying that off over time. Another very important trend to note is that federal funding is very uncertain. When Congress passed the FAST Act, they transferred significant amounts of money into the Highway Trust Fund to make up for the fact that the revenues flowing into the Highway Trust Fund have not been sufficient to cover the spending levels for more than a decade. That's because the federal government has not raised the gas tax since 1993, and so we're essentially paying for transportation using dollars that are significantly worth less today. There is about $10 billion annual deficit between the revenue and the expenditures, and so every year that balance in the trust fund goes down. Congress has put over $100 billion of general fund resources into the trust fund, and in 2021, when the FAST Act expires, those resources will once again be exhausted. Congress will have two choices, essentially: either find additional general fund resources to backfill the shortfall, or cut the surface transportation funding by over a third. Neither of those are real appetizing, but we have to factor that into our long-term approach and recognize that we do face this uncertainty at the federal level.
Sure. Yes, sir. Vice Chair Vile.
And Travis, that last comment goes to our ability to really look forward and borrow more money, bonding, because if we've got reducing federal money coming in, we're going to have to take that into consideration in terms of any forecast we make. Isn't that correct?
Yeah. Chair McEwen and Representative Vile, the one good thing is because of this uncertainty, we have not pledged our federal revenue for bonding. And so we focus on the State Highway Fund. But we do obviously have to look at the entirety of our revenue streams as we look to the capital program that we'll have in the future and what would be funded by debt versus cash flow.
And none of the bonding, none of the bonding that you're talking about would be true private type of bonding, something that's paid back through user fees, tolling, et cetera, et cetera.
Chair McEwen, Representative Vile, we do not have any debt of that nature currently. It is certainly a potential aspect that is being discussed in the joint committees, work groups, particularly around congestion, looking at some of the mega projects in the Portland metro region, whether those could be built using tolling, for example, as a revenue stream. When we looked at the I-5 bridge replacement several years ago, we looked at potentially doing a public-private partnership in which you'd bring in a private firm to design, build, finance, operate, and maintain. It didn't look like that really penciled out. So we looked at actually getting a federal loan that would be repaid by tolling as the funding stream or the financing mechanism for that particular project.
Follow-up?
And what do you mean by it didn't look like that penciled out?
Chair McEwen, Representative Vile, with any major project, you look at different methods of delivering that project. And a public-private partnership is really a project delivery method. And so you look at a comparison. We call it a public comparator of, would you outsource this, do it purely as a private public-private partnership, or deliver it as a public toll-based project. What you find is that the cost of capital for a public-private partnership is higher because you're paying equity rates of return as opposed to the bonded debt, which is generally very low when we have access to those municipal bond markets. And so as a result, you have to find efficiencies with a public-private partnership in order to offset that cost of capital. Sometimes you can do that, but I heard one of my staff was on a call with California yesterday. You know, largest state in the union, they've got 700 active construction projects right now. One of them is a public-private partnership because it's really difficult to find the situation in which that is clearly a benefit to the taxpayers and the citizens of the state. So,
great. Thank you, Travis. Keep going.
Thank you. Another major factor is that gas taxes don't keep up with inflation.
Oh, I'm sorry. My apologies. Representative Noble.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just going back a couple slides where you talked about the completion of some projects, mm-hmm. and I very much appreciate you mentioning a project that's near and dear to everyone in my district in the Newburgh-Dundee bypass. But the way you framed it kind of concerns me because mm-hmm. I know we're just into the first of three phases.
Phase one.
And when you talked about the completion, I just wanted to make sure that ODOT doesn't see this as a completed project, because I know that in the past, I'll take the Highway 34 bypass, where we have a completed project, which is half the project that was originally mm-hmm. planned through the Corvallis area. So it was more of a comment in that we not just put a finality to a partial project.
Chairman, that's a nice point to get on the record. Thank you.
All right, so gas taxes also don't keep up with inflation. Most funding streams from taxes actually are somehow adjusted for inflation. Income taxes go up as incomes increase. Sales taxes go up with inflation. Property taxes go up as property values go up. But the gas tax and all of our driver motor vehicle fees aren't adjusted in that same way. So over time, we see that they are significantly eroded by inflation. Another factor that we're facing now is that fuel efficiency is increasing. The fuel efficiency of the Oregon fleet has gone up 8% in the last 8 years, and we expect this trend to continue for some time in the future. And as a result, the net revenue per mile that we receive is declining over time. I believe that you may hear at some point a little bit more about our Origo program. We're looking at whether charging by the mile instead of by the gallon might be a way to help bridge that gap and prevent our revenue stream from falling off a cliff.
They will be here next week. Thank you.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. So as a result of those two factors, when we looked back over the last 45 years, we found actually that the per capita contribution to the state highway fund that each Oregonian makes has actually fallen by about 20%. So essentially, because of fuel efficiency growth and inflation, Oregonians have gotten about a 20% tax cut, and that is a long-term trend. The funding for transportation goes down in the absence of legislative action to increase the rates. Going forward, we see that the net state highway fund revenue forecast shows that most of these sources are going to be flat. The gas tax is going to be declining slightly. Even as people drive more miles, they're going to be driving more fuel-efficient vehicles. So we're actually going to see that money going down. DMV revenue, after subtracting the cost of operating the DMV, will actually be declining or flat. Motor carrier revenue will go up slightly. So when we look at the overall total cost or total revenue coming in, net of costs, our net revenue is expected to be flat. And if you overlay inflation, as that red line is, you're actually going to see transportation funding from the state highway fund declining significantly in the coming years. One final factor I'd mention that was touched essentially by the last panel around transit is that our non-highway funding is generally inadequate in the state of Oregon. Public transportation is largely a federal and local responsibility in Oregon, with the state kicking in just about 4%. This is actually a chart that that will not show up. There we are. The Ms. Brown shared earlier that Oregon's per capita spending on public transportation is significantly lower than the national average. We rank 20th among the states and at a fairly low per capita level. So with that, I'll wrap up and be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. In rapid time, I appreciate that. Any more questions for Travis? I'm sure he'll be back before this committee, before the session is over, but any other last comments or questions? Travis, thank you so much for your good work.
You're welcome.
I'm going to close our informational hearing on transportation funding and very quickly move to a work session on House Bill 2568. Mr. Walker, can you give us a quick update on this?
Chairman McEwen, members of the committee, House Bill 2568 exempts vehicles operating under the authority of a public utility, telecommunications utility, public people's utility district, or cooperative rural electrification district to exceed maximum vehicle lengths in the event of a power disruption. We heard this bill on February 15th, and the basic problem is that during an emergency or power disruption, the power companies aren't able to get the permits necessary to carry longer loads that they may need to get the power restored. There is a dash one amendment that clarifies that the exemption from permits exists when unplanned power disruption happens outside of normal business hours of the permitting authority. And that's the original bill referenced emergencies, and in statute, the emergency is only declared by the governor. So this will narrow down exactly what the emergency is and when the power companies can operate without permits, provided that they go back and get those permits, I believe. So.
Chair McEwen, I move to adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 2568, dated 2/23/17.
Vice Chair Vial moves to adopt the dash one amendment stated 2/23/17. Is there any discussion? Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. Just for clarification, I followed up with folks after the initial public hearing, and in fact, counties and cities can declare emergency. However, for expedited service, I think this bill makes sense. I'm going to be a yes vote, but just to clarify that not only the governor can declare emergencies, counties and cities.
Thank you for that clarification, Representative Evans. And I know Ms. Joyce is here if we have any other technical questions. Is there any other discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. Vice Chair Vial.
Chair McEwen, I move House Bill 2568 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Vial moves House Bill 2598. This is 68. We have a little typo here. 2568 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, Clerk, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Evans.
Yes.
Representative McClain.
Aye.
Representative Noble.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Moretto.
Aye.
Vice Chair Meek.
Aye.
Vice Chair Vial.
Aye.
Chair McEwen.
Aye. The motion passes. Representative Witt, would you like to carry this bill?
Yeah, too.
Thank you very much. I'd also like to note that we will be rolling over House Bill 2910. We were lacking some paperwork on this, and we will be hearing it next Wednesday. Tim, what's going on next Wednesday? Very briefly.
Very briefly. Okay. We will have a work session on House Bill 2291, public hearings on 2491, 2290, 2464, and we will, provided we have the amendment and appropriate work papers, we will also work House Bill 2910 and an informational meeting on the road user task force and ORGO.
Which is what Travis was referring to earlier. Thank you all. On that note, we are adjourned. Note, we are adjourned. Was referring to earlier. Thank you all. On